This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Hey, welcome everyone. Carm Capriato, Aftermarket Weekly, week 159. Can you believe it? Welcome, Pete.
Hey, Carm, how you doing?
I'm great, Pete. Good to see you. Pete Meyer, Creative Director, Technical Vehicle Repair Group, Endeavor Business Media. Is that the same title? Am I right?
What a mouthful, right?
It is a mouthful. I can't believe it. You know, it only took, 45 years, right? We're here to have Pete do a repeat of something he did for about 600 shop owners and technicians in New York at the TST event this year in 2023. And I so loved it. And Pete and I have been playing schedule catch up. And we finally got him on the show to talk about and to tell us his particular slant on electric vehicles, where we're going. And it was such a fun keynote. And I said, you know, I think the rest of the world needs to see this. So that's why he's here. Hey, look, we're coming to you live from the Dorman OE Fix studio. So glad to have Dorman as a continuing sponsor.
Dorman Products creates hundreds of new automotive replacement products every month. Part of what makes Dorman so unique is their ideation of new and innovative products. They have dedicated teams all across the U.S., Mexico, and Canada looking for new product ideas. Since every solution starts with a problem, these teams of researchers, field analysts, product specialists, and contributors consistently visit repair shops and make field calls. Now, this is to best understand the problems the industry is facing. In certain cases, Dorman will manufacture aftermarket replacements so you aren't forced to go back to the OE. Other times, experts take it an additional step, further solving what made the original part problematic in the first place. Solving for a problem is what powers the innovation engine at Dorman. Dorman Products has become an incredible engine for innovation. They are constantly bringing new replacement parts to the automotive industry, and they routinely release tens of thousands of parts across all different categories. Now, why do they do all of this? To enable technicians the freedom to fix their customers' cars and trucks. To do this, Dorman has dedicated teams focused on different aspects of the vehicle to ensure that they are meeting the needs of the aftermarket. Although a lot of their parts are reverse engineering of original equipment, they also redesign and redefine solutions such as their loaded knuckles or programmable electronic power steering rack. Dorman has invested in these OE Fix innovations to help you save time, your customer money, and prevent vehicles from coming back to your shop. In certain cases, Dorman will manufacture aftermarket replacements so you aren't forced to go back to the OE. Hey, want to know more about Dorman? Visit DormanProducts.com/tour.
Hey, thank you so much, Dorman. Look at Pete. I so enjoyed it. It was smart presentation. And that's all I can say about it, because it got me thinking and it got me, you know, challenging the think that's going on out there. And, you know, are we really paying attention enough as an industry, as shop owners, as technicians? And what are we telling our customers? And that was a really cool educational piece. So I'm not going to get in your way. I'm going to kind of sit here. I may have a comment or two as we do this thing, but let's bring up the presentation. The EVs are coming. Take it away, Pete.
That's what we're all talking about nowadays. In fact, it's in the newspaper, it's on the nightly news, industry trade publications, industry of, you name it, wherever you go, you hear this big noise about the electric vehicle and the oncoming wave that's going to be washing over us in the very, very near future. I wanted to kind of take the antithesis to that concept and just share some background that I learned after doing a little bit of research that might help put some of this in perspective. So if you look at this, this is forecasted sales of hybrid and battery electric powered vehicles over the next few years. And, you know, we're talking about going totally electric by 2035 and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the reality is maybe 40-45% of the new cars being sold will be EV by 2030, maybe 2035. We're not going to hit total 100% electric vehicles sold new by 2035. It's just not going to happen. So one thing I want to consider too is that, yeah, while you're going to see a rise in the sale of these type of vehicles, you got to keep in mind that the U.S. fleet of cars on the road is 12 to 14 years old. That's going to continue as a marker. So 2035, yeah, we're going to have a lot of cars on the road that are 12 to 14 years old. 2050, you might see 100% sales by then of EVs, but still the previous 12 or 14 years is going to come into play. In other words, there's going to be a lot of gas and diesel burning vehicles on the road for quite some time to come yet. The only way around that is they're going to just outlaw them completely. And I don't think that's going to happen.
And I think it's an excellent point that you make, is that we're not going to hit a brick wall.
This is not the first appearance of the electric vehicle. In fact, it was one of the very first horseless carriages, if you will, back in the early pre-1900s. The very first propulsion system was steam power, but you can imagine how much of a headache that was to get the fire going, to get the water boiling, especially if you live up in Buffalo in the middle of wintertime. That could be a challenge. So that just didn't go over very well with those who could even afford the idea of this new thing they were calling the horseless carriage. But when the first electric battery was invented, it didn't take long for inventors of the time to marry that to that chassis and create the very first electric vehicles. Here you see a picture of Thomas Edison kind of taking a look at that. It's interesting to note that he and Henry Ford actually worked for a time in partnership to help develop the electric vehicle and to try to make it more mainstream. Here at that time, though, the first batteries were not rechargeable. So that was a headache. But when they did become rechargeable, you're going to see that the aristocrats of the time really took electric vehicles to heart over the up-and-coming automobile gasoline-powered vehicles of the time. And why not? I mean, they were clean. They didn't require any manual labor to get it started. They were quiet. They just appealed to the classes that could afford them at the time. The problem was it wasn't the market, per se, that they were looking for. So on to the next slide, and you can see what really kind of started to put the death toll on the first EVs, and that was the Model T Ford of Henry Ford. Here you're looking at a vehicle that at the time, because of mass production, he could offer this vehicle for sale for about $650, as opposed to the electric vehicles at the time running about $1,750. You can see very quickly that this made a lot of sense for that working class American to take a look at. Kind of interesting to know, we've all heard that very famous quote that Henry Ford used to say, in any color you want, as long as it's
black.
Of course. Do you know why it had to be black? That was the only color paint at the time that would cure and fast enough to keep up with production.
Right. Okay.
So he wasn't slowing his assembly, his moneymaker down for anything.
I'm not a paint guy, Pete, but I would want to know why. Is there less additives or different kind of additives in black?
Oh, I couldn't begin to tell you the paint scheme back in those days. I just know that that's what my research showed.
Oh, by the way, just to talk about the electric vehicle, I remember being at the Peterson Museum in LA, oh gosh, maybe 6 years ago now, and one of the original electric battery vehicles is on display there.
What was really cool, and is not uncommon to what we're looking at today, is that it was really, really the Wild West of automotive innovation. There were a lot of startups, as we have now in the electric vehicle arena. Yes, basically the powertrains are the same, but everything else is wide open for them to do as they see fit. And I mean, look at, of course, Tesla, Polaris, which I got to drive one of those not too long ago. And just so many others that are out there, you know, vying for this new transportation segment. But again, it's really not new. It's been around for a while. It just kind of got pushed out. And I tell you what, though, was really kind of intrigued me was, you know, we talk a lot about the environmental issues that the electric vehicle is supposed to solve. The first EVs were also there to solve an environmental issue of sorts. What you're looking at here is a picture of New York City circa 1900, and you can see, if you look closely, that there are many, many, many horse-drawn conveyances on the road, very, very few automobiles, if any, and the very first environmental issues of the time were quite literally, I'm sure I want to make sure I say this, don't get in trouble, horse caca.
Yes, I was going to say there's a whole bunch of brown stuff all over the road there.
You think about it, in New York City alone, 100,000 horses at any one time, all taking care of their business, wherever they happened to be at the time. So it was versus expensive struggle to maintain or keep up with. And in those parts of the city where it wasn't as good, it was problems of its own. So only a span of 13 years, you're seeing the landscape in the city change entirely. Now you see very, very few, if any, horse-drawn conveyances on the road. It's all some form of automobile. Of course, the gasoline car taking the lead.
I'm going to go back just mentally a few moments to Thomas Edison. My daughter Tracy's getting married in September of this year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's Chautauqua Institute, and the hotel she's at was the first ever hotel to be electrified.
Wow.
And how it got done like that was that the son-in-law of the owners of the hotel was Thomas Edison. And he stayed there. They built him a house in Chautauqua, and you can walk by it and see the plaque on it. It says Thomas Edison lived here. But anyway, yeah, interesting story. You know, it's amazing how Edison connects to so many things, isn't it?
Yeah, and just for the technologies related to the automobile, we talk all the time about the new technologies, including EV. And the reality is most of them are not new. We just have the ability now to maximize them and make them effective in the vehicles that we're driving today. This was another period in history that I really love this photograph, and I'll tell you why. That is an old Texaco gas station.
I see a Dodge and a Chevy. I mean, wow, look at those cars. That's got to be 70 what, Pete?
Late 70s, yeah. And I like this picture because that's where I got my start in the automotive industry. I was the man with the star, the big, bright Texaco star, pumping gas. And it was a very interesting time of history as well. This is many of the folks listening or watching probably don't remember the oil crisis of the 70s, the OPEC crisis, where gas was short. You know, it was like wartime rationing. You had to alternate days. You were limited to how much fuel you could buy. It was a very, very challenging time until the fuel ran out. And I was part of that, you know, having to explain to angry consumers why, hey, can't help you. There's nothing left in the tanks because of that period of time. The other thing I thought was kind of interesting, if you look right there in the foreground, you'll see this little dark green vehicle right below the Texaco sign. That's an old Dodge Dart Swinger.
Yes, I was going to say a Swinger. Yes.
That was the second vehicle I ever owned. It cost me $500.
I love it, a Swinger. Oh, I had a brother-in-law that had one. Okay, that's why I recognize it right away.
Another interesting point about this time in history, Carm, was that you know, EVs kind of made just a kind of a peek over the horizon. Nothing big. But what did occur was the government, Congress passed the Electric and Hybrid Vehicle Research and Development Act in 1976 to encourage and support electric vehicle R&D, even as far back as the late 70s.
Pete, was there buy-in on that, do you know, or did it just take this many years to get the technology going? You know, did it take like 30 years?
A lot of folks listening, watching, probably are looking at this photo and either thinking that it's out of focus or it's old and decaying. But nope, that orange-brown stuff you see hovering over the city of Los Angeles is what we used to call smog. And it was a direct result of exhaust emissions, particularly NOx. So this became a very real issue. And in fact, it kind of put California out there in the forefront as being the first governmental body in the world to enact emission standards. And of course, that was followed up very soon at the federal level with the Clean Air Act that we're all familiar with, especially if you do air conditioning. We're still doing that Section 609 certification as part of that, and I'll go into that a little bit more. But this is when you started seeing catalytic converters starting at the end of leaded gasoline, and it means to address a very real environmental issue, pollution, air pollution. Actually, it was the first mass-produced EV in the country. That's the GM EV1. It was built over a three-year period. They were only built 1,100 of them. So the market never really embraced the concept of EV. There wasn't any big push by the government. But, you know, that's when we started seeing that, okay, it's in the wings, it's there. And this is what I kind of refer to as the second resurgence of the EV. But you move on to the next slide, you're going to see what did catch on. And we all recognize the Toyota Prius hybrid. Here we're marrying electric and ICE, internal combustion, together to improve fuel economy and lower our dependence on foreign fuel sources. That's how all that was marketed. And, you know, do something for the environment at the same time. You know, burn a little cleaner, less fuel. What's interesting, too, though, that this, again, was not a first. Ferdinand Porsche was actually the first to develop a hybrid back in the 1900s. Things would be so much different if back in those days, Henry Ford and Edison had been successful at being able to mass produce an electric vehicle. We'd all be driving them now. And we'd all have all these concerns about environmental impacts with the batteries and other issues. And then here was some guy come along with a new car that was running on oh my gosh, gasoline and burning very cleanly. We've done a great job of addressing what's coming out of the tailpipe. And gosh, you could get this thing back on the road again in a matter of minutes at the fuel pump. It didn't take hours to get your fuel supply back up to speed. And it would really take on. And of course, I kind of feeling our government would go like, oh, that's wonderful. That's the greatest thing since sliced bread. We got to get everybody in the gasoline auto car.
So interesting about the Prius. Japan had it first in 1997, and I think it was 2001 when it was introduced in the U.S. So it's been around a long time.
Oh, yeah. Actually, 1999.
Oh, 99? Okay.
Yeah, so it's been around quite a while. And again, the fuel economy was one of the big things. And the next slide kind of talks a little bit about that. I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of what's called the CAFE standards. This is a federal requirement of the manufacturers. The corporate average fuel economy that they have to achieve. And this has been pushing the OEMs for some time now. Now, the numbers were a little bit higher. They were recently modified. The target now is 49 miles per gallon fleet economy by the model year 2026, which is what, around the corner. So it's not very far off at all. And what was interesting is that, you know, while it relates to fuel economy, it's really got nothing to do with fuel economy. The government doesn't really care how many miles per gallon your car gets or how much you pay at the pump. You know, what they're concerned with, again, is the emissions. This is just another way to measure the impact of CO2 emissions, greenhouse gases. Of course, the less fuel we burn, the more economy we get out per mile, the less we're adding to the problem, right? So that's really what it is. It's a measure of emissions and not a measure so much of fuel economy. And that's really comes a sticky point. The idea of global warming, climate change, CO2, really a loaded pistol. It really depends on what side of the fence you're on. A lot of people are convinced it's all a myth, and while others are absolutely convinced that it's the truth, let's take a little closer look at all of that. What exactly is that? CO2 makes up 80% of the greenhouse gas emissions that we're concerned with. But there's only a few gases that are classified as greenhouse gases. And what does that mean? It means they're like an insulating blanket. It's like building that plastic shed in your backyard for your wife's plants, right? It keeps the heat in. And that's really where the issue that they were concerned about is warming, slowly warming up the planet and the impact it has on the climate. And maybe there's some truth to that. I mean, if you look at just how many serious tornadoes we've had in recent years, massive hurricanes, earthquakes where we never thought we'd have an earthquake. You know, who knows? I'm no scientist, but I know that a lot of people feel very strongly that this is a contributor to that. I'm also interested in learning that there are others in gases on this list. And you see the next biggest slice is methane. But the next slice of the pie there is methane gas. It's 11% of the contributors. But methane is 25 to 30 times worse than CO2. So it's a smaller amount being emitted, but it's a whole lot worse in terms of its impact on the environment. And we'll talk about where methane gas comes from in a bit. And then nitrous oxide, of course, we know where that's coming from. We've done a great job of cleaning that up in our exhaust after treatments. So the transportation sector is not contributing like it used to. Fluorinated gas, that's why we have 1234YF now, because of its warming potential is so much smaller than the 134A that it's replacing. I love seeing this picture of St. Greta actively pushing for change. You got to get those dirty automobiles off our roads, or you're going to kill all us young people and we won't have a planet to live on. And I admire her. She's kind of become the spokesperson. I get it. But what is all the truth? What does all the truth relate to the hype that she's generating? Let's see. Who's really the blame for the CO2? Doesn't take long to see that, hey, look at that. China's putting out over a third of greenhouse gas emissions on the planet. And I think if you look, China really is pushing for its citizens to drive electric vehicles, but fat lot of good that's going to do when 70% of their electricity comes from coal-burning plants, right? So, and because of their successful economy, their growing economy, they're not going to slow that down anytime soon. They're not going to take the shot in the economy from slowing down production. So that's part of it there. Unfortunately, we come in number two at nearly 20% of the emissions. Then India rounds off the top three at 9%. Between these three countries, that's two-thirds of the greenhouse gas emissions on the planet. You see Japan listed, you see Russia listed. What really tickles me is the rest of the world, 27%. Everybody else is only contributing to 27% to this issue. I thought that was very impactful. Now, let's take a look at where it is coming from by economic sector. you can see that we're interested in transportation that over on the right side at 14%, and that's globally again. So just think, if we were able to electrify every transportation sector, that would be passenger car, light truck, heavy duty, aircraft, marine, rail, anything that moves on our highways or byways or railways. If we could electrify all of that tomorrow, we're still only putting a very small dent into what's contributing to the problem. I mean, worldwide agriculture is almost twice that as a contributor. What is agriculture contributing? Methane gas. Guess where that's coming from? The cattle poop and the chicken poo and the pig poo. And in fact, there was a news story not too long ago of a cattle ranch out in the Midwest that was actually converting cattle waste into methane gas for use as a power source. I mean, that's just kind of tickled me as well. On to the next one, we'll take a closer look at what's going on here in the U.S. You see here that the transportation sector is much larger. Of course, we've got more cars than anybody, so that kind of explains that. But again, over half is industry and the production of electric power. I guess what I want to kind of stress here is that the goal is to make things cleaner, to lower greenhouse gas emissions. But the answer is not entirely in changing the type of car that we drive. We've got to look at the entire process from start to finish. You know, when these cars, the materials have to be mined, the parts have to be made, they have to be assembled, the cars have to be maintained. And once they reach the end of their service life, then we have to find a good way to reclaim those materials. So it's an entire picture that has to be looked at. And all these other factors have to be considered in order to address the issue that the government is telling us they so desperately want to address.
Yeah, between industry and electric power, that's like almost 49% compared to the transportation side. So great slide. I mean, it really does say a lot there. By the way, Pete, I want to stop and remind everyone that this is on our YouTube channel, okay? And there will be a link to the show notes and just about any place you can catch this podcast by looking at the show notes and then just clicking on the watch it on YouTube. In case you're saying, I want to see Pete's slides, you'll be able to see him if you're listening just audio only. There it is. The vegans' fault.
There we go. It's all the vegans' fault. My God. Agriculture contributes 12%, 11% to greenhouse gases. And what are the vegans doing? They're eating the plants. The plants are supposed to convert the CO2 to oxygen. That's supposed to be our normal filtration system. They're killing our filtration system. What's up with that?
Talk to the hand because the face ain't listening.
Yeah, and then one more click and you're going to say, hey, look, we've talked about contributing to agriculture. It's methane gas. If you really want to be a patriotic American and do your part to end global warming, you're going to eat more beef or chicken or pork.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, chicken, pork, yeah. Protein, baby.
Eat the cause of the methane.
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, put that methane producer on your plate as a nice piece of prime steak. I get it. I get it.
Convert a vegan today. Right? That's a bumper sticker. One of the things now has a groundbreaking world-leading plan to achieve 100% zero emissions vehicle sales by 2035. Well, Governor Newsom, it's not going to happen. But what's interesting to note about this California rule is that first, I want everybody to pay attention to the fact that it says zero emission. It doesn't say electric vehicle. It says zero emission. There's a difference, right? And what's also interesting to note is that this does not prohibit any Californian from going out of state and buying whatever they want and bringing it home, right? So those of you out there who are ranching in the mountains of California or wineries there doing your thing, and you want to drive that big old dually, no problem. Just go over to Nevada, buy it there, and drive it home, right? So you'd be all right there.
I find it fascinating that we're creating rules as a society that almost you could go to bed at night as a legislator in California and say, I don't know why we did this. It's never going to happen. I mean, to me, there's some common sense and reality that needs to kick in. But a lot of people stretch and push and say, hey, if we can get 50, we're way ahead of the game, right?
Yeah. And the thing, too, with California is that they still certainly have a problem with vehicle emissions, for sure. There are certain categories near Los Angeles, the shipping harbors, where you have these big Class 8 tractors running continuously that are causing a severe problem. in the area, no question. And he's addressed that as well. I want to make sure I get this right. Don't hold me to this. But someone was telling me after we showed this presentation that California has now set up restrictions on Class 8 tractors. They have to be a certain model year or newer before they're allowed to operate within the state. And that includes out-of-state truckers bringing goods to California. So that's going to be a real harm. I mean, you think about it. If you have an old, big old tractor that you're using on your farm to deliver the grain to the granary, whatever the case might be, and there's nothing wrong with it, it's operating perfectly well. Well, guess what? If it doesn't meet this requirement, you have to go out and buy another one for no other reason than they said so. That, to me, is a challenge as well. But he's not the only one.
You know, Pete, too bad we can't put a catalytic converter on that stack.
Oh, hey. I mean, you look at the after-treatment systems on these modern diesels. I mean, what a wonderful job we've done. And I'm going to touch on that here in a bit. But all new light-duty vehicles added to the government fleet will be 100% zero emissions. There's that zero emissions again by 2027, with all new privately owned light-duty vehicles sold being 100% zero emissions by 2035. Well, again, I think I've shown you from that earlier graph right at the very beginning that that's all well and good, but it ain't going to happen. We just can't do it that quickly. We don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the production capabilities. There's just so many factors that are involved with that ain't happening. These are our friends in the European Union where all this kind of started. And they said beginning in 2035, all new cars that come to the market should be zero emissions. And then they added cannot emit any CO2. Well, that's a little more pointing a finger at internal combustion right there. But even now, there are European Union members who are pushing back on this deadline. So again, I don't think you're going to see this happen either. Not in the foreseeable future anyway.
Hey, Pete, I want to ask you a question. I thought I either read it or heard a rumor about Mercedes. They've made a commitment to electric. Now, I'm not sure if it's all electric or not, but someone was saying that they've made the commitment that they'll, if they, whatever models they have, they'll have an ICE and they'll have an EV in each model. Did you hear that?
I've seen bits and pieces of stories like that. I think what really intrigued me recently is Toyota's stance on hydrogen fuel cells.
Yeah, they're going to go hard on it, aren't they?
Yes, I think they are. And for valid reasons. I mean, it solves a lot of the issues that come with having to build these batteries and sourcing the materials, for sure. And they're not the only ones. I can't remember whether it was Kenworth or Peterbilt that announced they were coming to market with a fuel cell powered vehicle in the next few years. I don't remember exactly when the model year was, but they're ready to put this thing into production and get them on the highways. So I think you're going to see a lot of that come to pass.
I think you're 100% right. I don't believe we are ready and prepared for an all EV world, especially the, you know, the old stories of the power. What about the power grid? Well, I guess you're going to have to live with it, you know, and which is why I love the people that have the common sense, or they're just grounded in reality, are looking at so many other alternatives.
Well, again, if you look at what the fuel cell vehicles are putting on the tailpipe, it's water. Right. So that's zero emissions. That's not CO2. So that meets these requirements. You know, it's going to have its own infrastructure for sure, but probably not as difficult to put up as these electric charging stations might be. That I couldn't even begin to talk about. I'm no expert. These are things that I happened to read when I was doing some research on this topic for the TST event that really kind of stood out there in my mind. And that kind of leads us to the next slide there. The electric car, yes, might be the best solution at this point in time for zero emissions, no impact on global warming. But you have to, again, think of the entire life cycle of this vehicle. And that's what we're looking there in the background. That thing's still attached to a process that is nowhere near zero emissions. And the impact, as we saw in those graphs, unless you address those at the same time, the overall impact of just focusing on transportation, maybe it's going to make the politicians and the public feel good because that's what we're all harping on and seeing in the news. But that is not an end solution. I'll tell you what was really interesting. If you consider where we are now with the status of the facilities and the entire life cycle, the EV may be number one, but really running right on its heels are plug-in hybrids using internal combustion engines. They are just as, or pretty close to being just as greenhouse gas emission friendly as a pure electric. And think about it. If you start working on developing after treatment systems for the GDIs in Europe, some of these vehicles are using the same particular type of filter that the diesels use. And in some reports I've read, they're actually putting out of the tailpipe air that's cleaner than what went in. So there you go. There's your zero emissions, no CO2. That meets the requirements, right? If we can make that happen. We're also, Porsche has done a lot of research and development in synthetic fuels to, again, help with the overall greenhouse gas emissions, the whole package, if you will.
Pete, you know, I've always said, and you know, capitalism grounds my thinking here, is that capitalists will always look for opportunities and nature will find a way. And when I say nature, I don't necessarily mean, you know, the world that we live in, but the nature of capitalists and inventors and scientists and entrepreneurs that want to go out and say, I've got a better idea. And they invest and they try and they do version one, generation one of stuff. So for our industry, I look at all of these incredible opportunities of new tech coming at us. What a vibrant industry that will be for so many years.
I feel very fortunate, and technicians in my generation should consider themselves very fortunate in that we've been part of probably the biggest change in the automotive industry in history. I mean, when I started, they were mechanical points, ignition systems, carbureted engines, and now we're looking at all these computerized systems. We're looking at almost near autonomy here coming at us very, very quickly. And then we're looking at the hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles. We've all been a part of that beginning new revolution. And when I talk to technicians and shop owners, and they ask me, well, you know, how seriously do I need to take this EV thing? I tell them, well, you have to consider a few things. If you're a business owner, first thing you have to do is look at your market, right? If you're on the West Coast, you've already been dealing with this for a while, right? Some sections Northeast, same way. You've already been dealing with this for a while. If you're in the Montana, South Dakota, you may not have even seen a Tesla except when it passed you on the highway. And those good old boys, they ain't giving off their gasoline and diesel-powered dualies for anything. Not for a long, long while. And then we have the good old boys down here in Southeast where I'm at. You know, I don't think they can take a Ford Lightning mudding, you know, like they can a good old diesel F-250, right? And what I really want to stress here as we kind of wind this thing up, the industry, the OEMs have thrown us technology changes for ever since I've been in the business, as I mentioned. And they're doing it still now, but just at a much more lightning pace than we've ever done before. But what I would say to the technicians is, you've dealt with this from the past, no matter, and you've risen to the challenge each and every time. So don't freak, right? If you're kind of in my age group, or if you're in the tail end of your career, you can probably finish out and not worry in the least about mastering, you know, EV powertrain diagnosis. But if you're up and coming, if you just started, if you're in the first phases of your career, I would absolutely encourage you to seek out the training and education on these systems and from a good, reliable source. There are many out there who say they're training you for EVs and hybrids, but there are very few that are what I consider very, very good programs that are giving you the tools that you need to succeed. I'm not going to get into any names, so I'll get in trouble, but do your research, your considerations before you spend your money. But think of it this way, guys and gals, if you understand how EV powertrains work and how to diagnose them, we're not talking just about cars. Every transportation sector is going to move in that direction. You're going to be worth a mint to Class 8, heavy duty, maritime, aviation, you name it. Like I said before, if it moves product on the highways or byways or railways and it's EV, then you have an opportunity there to build a career in whatever you really want to do. And that's exciting. That's really exciting for the youngsters out there. But don't let it scare you off. We've risen these challenges before and we've met those challenges before. So we'll do the same here.
Pete, great advice. You are such a wise young man. Thank you for all you do for the industry and all the training. I mean, whatever emails I get, do you sleep? When do you have time to write a new class? Because you're always teaching and training and giving from the MotorAge and the TST group. And I think you do stuff with Dorman and so many other training companies. So thank you for your passion to help take us to the next level.
I really enjoy something that I've offered has made a difference in a tech's career. And that, for me, as you know, Carm, that's always been my guiding light. can I help that individual, male or female, make a better living for their families? And that's when I hear that happen, if somebody tell me that helped them, that's all I need.
One final thing, Pete. We did a great episode with you and your wife, Chris, episode 805, Remarkable Results Radio, on the passion to support abused children. Boy, Pete, what a compassion and passion that you have to help abused children. I just recommend, if you're new to the show or you missed this episode, go to my website, RR805, and listen to Pete and Chris talk about their passion. And of course, they would welcome any kind of donation that you could give. We have a link in there. I'm sure that the link is still active. I so enjoyed your keynote at the TSD big event, the 20th anniversary there. And I'm sitting in the audience, so enjoying the common sense way you presented it. Really, this was, if you will, for anyone, a way to understand, to accept, to qualify, to quantify where and why we're heading, where we are, and potentially when we'll get there. And I don't think anybody really knows, but there's a whole bunch of people that lead this country that say it's going to happen sooner than later. But, you know, if you look at what Pete just talked to you about, it's a nebulous thing. It's just out there.
Well, it's like anything else. You got a question what you're reading in the papers. You're getting the public message. You're getting what the politicians are currently pushing. And sometimes in my mind, it's a way to keep us off the things that really are more important to discuss. But we'll go there.
Listen, if you're listening through audio, I think you got a pretty decent verbalization of Pete's slides. But if you want to see the slides as Pete narrates them, please go to our YouTube channel or click the link in the show notes. Pete Meyer, Creative Director, Technical Vehicle Repair Group. What a title. Endeavor Business Media. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, bud.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.